The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
The only connection that I had to the country that we left behind, the life that we left behind, were the stories that my father would tell me. And I grew up kind of in this beautiful, beautiful, small, poor household where all that we had were the stories. What I thought was that everyone grew up with stories, and I realized that's not the case. That was instrumental in me deciding that, well, then let's make storytelling a thing for more people. Let's just make sure that other people will join in. It was as simple as that.
It's a wonderful chaos. Beautifully random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem?
We work to find rest and fight to find peace. Both head and the heart.
Like a nephew and niece.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healed
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way.
Da, 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 da. Hey, Mr. Chaliff.
Hey, Bambos.
I think it's one of the few times I've pronounced your last name correctly.
Really? And you know what I thought right before we came on air? The one question I didn't ask Sahan was how to pronounce his last name. So all we're going to do is call him Sahan for the moment.
Sahan.
We're going to call him Sahan. And we have Sahan and we have the life of a storyteller today.
You know Sahan from way back in the days.
Yeah, as I said, I knew him 10 kilos ago, at least. I think maybe more, quite honestly. But I knew Sahan when I first was living in the attic space in Amsterdam, when I first sold everything I owned and decided to change my life and move here. And I passed his little, and when I say little, I do want to mean little. Like you took three steps interior or four steps inside of this one room and maybe six steps back. And they'd pack this room with, say, I don't know, say 20, 30 people.
It was not corona friendly.
No, certainly not corona friendly. And I mean, and the thing is the energy was magic. Like it was a storytelling night and it was one of, you know, as I've seen things progress, I've seen the men's circles and women's circles. So people are getting far more comfortable with intimacy and sharing vulnerability in groups.
Yeah.
And what I noticed in this setting, the Mezrab, the first edition of it, it had three, and this is the first, was that Sahan created an atmosphere where you were playing in a way that was on the edge of what was comfortable. But it wasn't with any other notion than experimenting and enjoying and sort of flirting with experience. So there was not the, we're going to do a personal development course and let's have your self-awareness and how, where's your edge? You know, there was no emotional well-being except for the fact that you were being pushed at your edge of personal discovery through this act of storytelling, through playing music and through the experimentation without judgment. And that I found incredibly beautiful, especially at that point in my life when I was just leaving the corporate world. I was still trying to find out who I was really wanting to be. And this was a little bit of an adjunct place to experiment and see, you know, just how it felt to be a little bit off the beaten path.
Yeah. I actually today did a little bit of reading about storytelling. Like, so every day I try to read a little bit about the guest or about their craft.
Okay.
And apparently storytelling is a very powerful tool. Like everybody should have that as an part of their education, pretty much. You can use it in marketing, to sell your business, to promote yourself, to captivate your audience. So it's really, and I think even at Sahan's place, they also offer workshops on how to tell stories.
Yeah, and again, I think I've said, you know, my life was predominantly in the area of marketing.
Yeah.
And what I learned about marketing was that it's not really what you sell, but it's how you explain what you sell. And that, you know, it might sound absurd, but I think the strong empathy, that I've felt all my life made it easier for me to do marketing, because I sensed what felt like what pushed me away or alienated me and what drew me in. And if I look at storytelling, then storytelling is the ultimate craft of creating an idea, a vision, an experience in someone's head that they don't even know they're having. Yeah. Meaning you don't, it's almost guided so surreptitiously that it's like, at the meantime, you know, there's a hero's journey. So we already know here's the kind of crest of a story that one might tell. But in some strange way, it's like we're being manipulated. We don't even know it.
Right? Should we bring this manipulator on?
Yes, it's a master manipulator. Here we go. Hello, Sahad. Can you please pronounce your last name?
So at least hi, guys. Of course. So it's Saheb Divani.
Saheb Divani.
Mm-hmm. Saheb Divani.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. When I think of icons in Amsterdam, like you're in the icon state. Like there's characters. I'll pass them on the street and they'll be in my mind like, oh, that's one of those characters that has a domain of something that I have nothing associated with, and yet they've built an entire life around it.
Wow. Hmm. Amazing. You know, I made it. I'm an icon, Franzi. This is terrific.
Well, I'm sure you're that for a hell of a lot of people, right? Because if you think about it, like when someone looks at vision and visionaries and they talk about, I had a life passion, which was storytelling. And then I start in this sort of hole in a wall in the middle of Amsterdam. I mean, it was a hole. Let's get that clear.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It was a hole because I remember that the rent was 600 euros a month. And when I rented it, I had a room that was 600 euros a month. So I gave up my room and I rented this hole in the wall. And I knew that even if no one comes, you know, my balance is still equal because that's all the money that I have. And that's how it's going to start. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the way it felt. It felt like you were living your passion, whether the world was going to accept it or not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so tell me, like, how do you go from... I assume you were living in Iran with your family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to get back to that. What was the reason to flee and so on? But to start with, what is the thing that said, I am going to make storytelling relevant in my own life? How did that happen?
Well, it very much has to do with my family, Iran, because you have to imagine that I came here at the age of 3. And the only connection that I had to the country that we left behind, the life that we left behind, were the stories that my father would tell me. And I grew up kind of in this beautiful, beautiful, small, poor household where all that we had were the stories. And then what I thought was that everyone grew up with stories. And I realized that's not the case. My dad is the only person who every single night tells something crazy about something he experienced in Iran, or how the mountains look, or what you experience in jail when you're a political prisoner, or, you know, so this was a life of stories. And then when I realized that this is not the case for everyone, that was instrumental in me deciding that, well, then let's make storytelling a thing for more people. Let's just make sure that other people will join in. It was as simple as that.
Hmm. I want to take that in for a moment.
Yeah.
I even have to say I was emotional hearing you talk just now. Like there's something beautiful of your experience as through your childhood was that you discovered almost curiosity through this almost passion of your father's.
Yeah. Of course, his passion was related to his kids and the idea that, you know, that's what you are. You're a vessel to pass on things to your children, right? So when you see that your children will not experience firsthand so many things that you experienced, you realize that this tool that you have, you know, your voice, your words, your memories, that becomes so important.
Mm. What's the story that you remember most him having told you as a kid?
I think there isn't particular stories, but there was particular characters that keep coming back. And one was his grandmother, because you have to know that my father wasn't raised by his mother. His parents separated quite early. And he was raised by his grandmother, who was this... you know, kind of a woman from a different era. Like she still believed in jinns, in genies. And she was, you know, a Muslim who prayed, but at the same time would hide a beer bottle under her skirt and share it with my dad. And this, you know, this naughtiness of this woman, this this sort of, you know, the way that she had to kind of trick her way through life to be able to to provide for her kid, her son, and her grandchild. It was such a beautiful person. So there, it's weird that I carry her through the stories as well.
Well, I think that you probably identify with her, no? Is that kind of what you would say is the, like, you kind of feel that part of you? Or how would you describe that?
I would say so, because, you know, when I look at the ancestors, the ones that my father described for me, and even my father himself, if I try to identify what the characteristic is that they all have in common, there is always this hint of naughtiness, this hint of, you know, don't take yourself too seriously, approach every single task with just a bit of a smirk. And this is what I like. You know, my dad, he did crazy things in Iran. You know, he was a political activist. He was in jail for many years. But when he talks about it, he always has this anecdote about just, you know, being there with the guys, being there with his friends, men and women, and then just joking with each other and instilling in me this importance of not taking life too seriously, even when you're doing very serious things.
Mm. I mean, I assume he was in prison before you were born, or was that actually even what?
Yeah. So my dad and my mom, they were imprisoned in 73. This is in the time of the Shah.
Mm.
And he spent 4 years in jail. So he got out 2 years before the revolution. And then finally the revolution came in Iran. The Shah got kicked out. Khomeini came. I was born in 1980, 1 year after the revolution. And you know, even though people expected the revolution to bring good things, things only got worse and worse and worse and worse. Yeah. So in 83, we finally got out.
I kind of think of that song, Children of the Revolution? Is that song by David Bowie, I think? Children of the Revolution, no, we won't. it's like you really are a child of the revolution.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And then they fled Iran.
Yeah.
And you were how old were you at that time?
I was 3.
You were 3 when they fled. Do you have any memory of that time?
Well, it's funny. I had a few memories, and I actually turned the memories into a story, into a show that I've performed, I think by now, a couple of hundred times. And it's a memory that I had about crossing the mountains on horseback through the snow with my mom.
Wow.
And this was us going through Kurdistan into Turkey, knowing that, you know, in Turkey, potentially we'd be safe and we can flee on to the next place we needed to go. And then I had a memory of visiting my dad in prison in Istanbul, because he had fled a few months before us. But then he was caught in Turkey, and then he was put in jail. But the funny thing is that I've told this story hundreds of times. And at some point I realized I don't actually remember those scenes anymore.
Mm.
So the moment that I turned the memories into stories, obviously I did remember them, but now I remember remembering them, but yeah. I don't actually remember being in those mountains. I don't actually remember being in that prison. So that's the weird thing about memory.
Isn't it? I've talked about it a bit on prior shows where I'll look at photos from my childhood and then believe that I know the memory behind that photo, and then only see that I've created a story around it, plus people who have maybe shared a few things.
Yeah. Exactly.
In fact, I got in trouble with my first book because I basically told the story of my brothers pouring chlorine into the frosted flakes and me eating them, which, you know, I was pumped. My stomach was pumped at a 1-year-old. And then, you know, my 5-year-old brother at that time says, Andy, that's not what happened. And I laugh because basically, so my two brothers were 3 and 5, and they're like contesting that story. And then I was on the phone with them yesterday and said, listen, I will acknowledge the memory of a 1-year-old isn't as good as the 3 or the 5-year-old. So yes, it's now in public domain. My brothers did not try to poison me. That line in the last book was incorrect. I strike it and I apologize publicly.
They will haunt you.
They're both lawyers, and they both felt like, Andy, that could, you know, disrupt our business. People knew at 3 years old, 5 years old, we were trying to kill you.
I think we should bring Andy to Mezrab and have him perform some of these stories.
Totally. Totally. He'd kill on stage. Yeah.
I have a question.
Go ahead, please.
Does your father know how much he has impacted your life? Like, was that even acknowledged?
Definitely. And there is a, you know, there's a lot of acknowledgement in my work because I work a lot with stories of my family and specifically stories of him and the stories that he told me of previous generations of people that I never met. But with that acknowledgement, also something difficult came because you have to imagine that I come from a culture similar to many sort of non-Northwestern European cultures where, or even non-Dutch cultures, where you don't so openly speak about what happened in your family. So, you know, this is something that also someone from Greece will recognize. You know, you might have a mother who might, you know, drink too much, a dad who's smoking and, you know, cheating and doing this and that. But you will never say that in public. You know, you might say that to your friends, you know, when you're in private. But it's there is this culture of keeping your family stories with you. Now, we have a huge storytelling tradition, but this thing of getting on stage and mixing the old stories, you know, the traditional stories with the personal stories, that was something that was very weird for Iranians and specifically for my dad. And there was a time, there was actually great many years that he found it a little bit difficult. Of course, his pride won it from his shame. So he would never allow himself to tell me not to tell the stories. But he would sometimes tell me, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable when you get on stage and tell people how my mother, so his mother, you know, my grandmother, how she would smoke opium, you know, these kind of stories. You know, he wouldn't like it. And it's only a few years ago, actually, around the time that he turned 70, 71, that for the first time my father came to me and said that he really liked it. And then he volunteered to tell me even more stories for me to tell on stage. Yeah.
But he didn't get on stage himself then.
Well, I've also to acknowledge what he gave me, a few times I've dragged him on stage. And then, you know, what I can offer people by getting him on stage is his presence, because he's a very beautiful and powerful man. They get to hear his voice, they get to hear his gestures, but they won't get to understand a full story because he'll be able to do them in Persian. And maybe in very, very broken Dutch or English, but, you know, not good enough for an audience. But I'll just, you know, I might put him on stage. We might do a little bit together of a few minutes. And then I'll continue the stories. But I'll make sure that somehow, you know, people do get to see the man that he is.
There is an interesting point there, is that I've seen everyone in your family, and you've got a very close-knit family. Mm-hmm. And your parents are quite shy, humble people. Like, you tell me your dad's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. If you were to meet him, you would just find him to be just a beautifully soft man. Even the fact that he was a revolutionary feels a little bit out of place because he doesn't hold himself with any level of aggression at all.
Mm-hmm. No. So I think there's two things at play there. One is that migration completely changes your character. And it can go in both directions because there's people who, you know, in their own country, you know, might be even a bit of a loser. And then they come in a new country and they completely reinvent themselves. And they say, you know, back in the day, I was a very important person. And I had, you know, all these people listening to me. And people here believe them. And it gives them confidence. And then they become big. And then you have people for whom it goes the other way around. And I think my dad is a prime example of that. You know, in Iran, he would have been the icon. He would have been the person that a lot of people knew in the street. You know, he was almost a professional athlete. You know, he was almost selected for the Olympics. The only reason he didn't make it to the Olympics is because he broke his ankle playing street football. But, you know, he was getting his records in athletics, and people were getting to know him also as a revolutionary. And then suddenly he comes in a new country where, you know, he doesn't speak the language. No one knows the story. And most people don't even care. So it kind of naturally made him kind of go into himself. And this guy who used to have hundreds or thousands of friends in Iran, you know, now his friends are his books and his friends are his memories and his friends are his kids to whom he tells the stories. So there is this process that you will see happening with a lot of people and in both directions.
Yeah.
You're a great storyteller. Have I told you that?
Thank you.
As I was listening just now, I noticed you had my attention to such a point. You captivated me.
That's great because that doesn't happen often, Sahan. So you really got him. That's good.
That was the point I was going to bring. Maybe our guest should work with Sahad.
Yeah, we'll say watch Sahad go to training before we invite you on, so that Dombo doesn't snot off.
Great, we can call it the Bambos test of excellence. When we train them, you know, when we want them to be professionals, we'll send them over to you. That'll be the test.
You know, I'm working, interestingly enough, I've been working with a company in the UK, the Verity Foundation. They do a lot with films. They do documentary films. The foundation, actually, the name of the company itself, it'll come back to me. But the thing I found very fascinating is in the middle of London, and they've got one floor that's dedicated only to storytelling. So they hire staff that come in only for storytelling, because they've decided that storytelling is so critical to how life and people understand, and that they said we need to dedicate an entire group just to that craft.
Absolutely.
Which I found really quite amazing. Yeah.
We see this beautiful resurgence of it in many different strata of society. Even in a theater school where, you know, a lot of actors and directors thought that, you know, what they did was art and storytelling was this little amateur thing done by a bunch of people. Now they've started to make storytelling part of the curriculum.
Yeah. It's called the Bertha Foundation, by the way. Sorry, now that I remember the Bertha Foundation, they do a lot of films for people that have been put in prison incorrectly. And then they basically expose all of the things going on that aren't really, you know, seen, because we found nice ways to hide them behind politics and so on. When you transition not only from storytelling but from doing like really plays, far as I can say, when there was one play, as we spoke early before you came on, My Father Held a Gun, which won the Amsterdam 2017 Fringe Festival Award for being the best performance that year. So when you go into creating something like that, like, what's the inspiration behind it? Like, where do you say that's where I want to focus my energy?
Yeah. Well, that piece, and also a piece that I made before called Kingdom of Fire and Clay, it was very much born out of my meeting with who is now a very dear friend and a very close colleague, Rafael Rodin. And, you know, it happens very rarely in your life that you find that person with whom you have this click that gives you so much. And sometimes the click is in how similar you are, and sometimes it's in how opposite you are. Mm. And with this particular character, this friend of mine, Rafael, we have both. So there is things in which we're very similar and things in which we're very different. Now, in what we were similar is that we're both two young men from the Middle East, who were trying to make it in what then was quite a white art. You know, there was, you know, storytelling was mostly, you know, middle class white, middle-aged people doing kind of old folk tales. So you had these young two kind of passionate artists. And then one being from Israel and one being from Iran also, you know, created a beautiful tension between us.
Yeah.
Even though we kept finding the similarities. So, for instance, we found out working that his mother is actually Iranian, but from the Jewish community from Iran, who she had left Iran in the 70s. And my parents had left Iran because, you know, being atheists, they couldn't, you know, find their way in that religious society. So this meeting made us kind of create art that kind of went beyond the, you know, just one person standing on stage and telling you something nice. We allowed ourselves to create work that also was a bit harsh and a bit hard to swallow. We dared to ask uncomfortable questions about, you know, political issues. We didn't want to smooth things over with our audiences. And that was appreciated. This is why that became a success. Mm. And also professionally, meeting him, it kind of fed into our art, because I went into storytelling from, you know, what I described before, just living a life of hearing beautiful stories. He came into storytelling from actually studying theater.
Wow.
So the meeting of these two people, you know, one person comes into it from a more sort of practical side and one from a more theoretical side, also made that we had an art praxis that fed on both sides. And that's when we managed to create this style of work, which is, you know, with one leg in storytelling and with the other in theater.
That's fascinating. It kind of follows up with a question. We have one of our daily listeners,
Bolelan,
has a question. Is there a simple high-level formula for successful storytelling?
Oh, wow. So if I can say two things that is incredibly important in making sure that your story is successful, and I'm going to limit myself to telling personal stories, I would say that, first of all, tell something that you think is important. So if you don't feel the personal necessity of what it is that you want to tell, it will not come across. Like, I know why me talking about my dad was important to me. It's because, you know, when I was a kid, I looked up to this beautiful man, and I grew up in a society where I saw that the rest of the people had no idea who he was. They just thought, oh, he's some poor immigrant from behind the mountains, doesn't know how to read or write. And that frustrated me, that angered me. Mm. And I managed to turn that frustration and that anger into something productive. So you need to know what the drive is, why this particular story is important for you. And that can help you propel it. And the second thing that I would say is that some people, they want to talk about a particular issue, and then they'll just talk and mention anything that they can remember connected to that issue. Whereas it's much stronger if you want to talk about a particular issue, but you find one incident in your life that actually illustrates that issue. So if you want to be successful in your stories, find the one incident that you want to talk about. So there you have it, two formulas for the price of
that's,
one.
I would like to stick with that second one for just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it, I'm just looking at, say, my own brain function and relating it to something on a more meta level that I've seen throughout my life, is that oftentimes when you look at a problem, you say, hey, where are all the instances in that where I've had that problem in my life? And then, as you said, you might try to tell a story, including all 10 of those instances. And I believe it's harder for us to believe and trust ourselves that the one single instance could be more interesting than the 10.
Absolutely.
So we actually fall back on what like the lazy route, which is like, oh, let me just tell you the 10 instances.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you have friends who do drugs, who sometimes smoke a joint, just remind yourself how annoying it was that they got into this talking kick. And they kept talking about an issue, and you already got it after the second minute, but they keep talking for 25 minutes about the same thing. So just, you know, use that as an example for yourself and limit yourself to the one instance.
And you know what, like the movies that I've been enjoying far more lately are these movies that have one nuanced situation without any real, like, it's like the innocence of simple storytelling is so much more compelling than like a major drama with a lot of chase scenes. I don't know if you saw the movie, The Marriage Story. It was a Netflix.
Not yet. It's high on my list.
It's like I leave and I need to take a shower afterwards because I'm so emotionally disturbed at how well it's acted and how a simple story can give you so much more intense feelings than some, you know, crazy, you know, chase film.
Absolutely.
And that film does. I spoke to the woman who was in charge of marketing it for Netflix.
Is she coming on?
I tried to get her on, and she said that her boss said she wasn't so excited about her discussing the secrets of Netflix on air. But the thing is that that story didn't do well in America. It did great in Europe. Yeah.
Wow.
Because the stories they're trying to pump out in America have more action. They're more, they need less of this
stimulation. Sort
of, they need more stimulation.
Wow.
So the European stories are the simpler stories that have far more of this elegant softness to them, that subtle. It's the subtle beauty. Like the Japanese movies are very similar in that regard.
Yeah.
Bolelang says, thank you for your answer, by the way.
Welcome. Yeah. And I need to craft a different one for American audiences. Yeah, just add guns and explosions to any story.
Yes, just add guns and explosions. They're used to it.
Well, my father held a gun.
Yeah, yes. That's what you...
Yeah, by the way, you know, joking aside, that story also was inspired by crazy explosions that happened in Europe. So if I may just tell the short anecdote about what happened. We were doing our previous show, which was a bit softer, and it was about our mothers and how they were similar and different. And we were doing the show in Brussels. And we play two nights out of five nights that we were booked there. And on the third day, the third morning that we wake up to prepare, suddenly our producer tells us, hey, are you guys okay? And we don't know what's going on. And then we realize we're in the middle of a terrorist attack. So we're in Brussels and they've just attacked the subways. And we at some point go into the street because we want to know what's happening. And we see all these armored vehicles and we see these young Belgian men with guns, holding guns, and they're guarding the place. And it's, of course, it's scary and it's weird and you feel uncomfortable. And for us, there's this added layer of we're scared because we don't know what's happening. But at the same time, we realize that when people look at us, they think that potentially we're the type of people.
Yeah.
And I feel suddenly very self-conscious. I wanted to go and sit in a place with my backpack, with my laptop, to just write some thoughts down. I realized people are going to see me with a backpack and they're going to be uncomfortable. And then I'm angry at myself for feeling guilty just about the way that I look. It's a very complex time. But at that moment, we realized that these young men, you know, they're there guarding whatever it is that they can guard. And Rafa and I, whose show has just been canceled, we have fathers who also held guns for their beliefs. One served in the Israeli military. The other one, you know, he was a resistance fighter. And then we realized that we are of the generation who's never held a gun. I grew up in the Netherlands and I was of the first year of the people who was not called for the military service. And Rafa, he got out of his military service. So we were the first two people who never went to the military. So, you know, I can joke about, you know, these explosions, but it is something that did inspire us to also question this part of life, which, you know, maybe is not something I want to look at every day, but it is very much part of who we are.
I feel really touched when you actually made that statement. I felt uncomfortable with how I looked.
Yeah.
Like that is a title of a book.
Yeah, I felt really creepy inside because I just thought to myself, I have a very dear friend that's gay. And he visited me at the airport. And when he arrived, I put my hand around him as if we were even going out. One might mistake it for a sexual relationship. And I thought immediately afterwards, wow, it just dawned on me. I was comfortable with it. And then I got self-conscious. I could be attacked for this.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, especially, you know, you see it all going on in the US right now, is that they've never allowed the empathy to see how uncomfortable it could be to be the minority of anything. Yeah. So they assume that, hey, everyone's like me, you know, even if they do have a little bit of a racist thing, but they're not even ready to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so racist that I'd ever really make a problem of it. Not knowing that there's 30% of the population that is comfortable with it, you know? Yeah. Have you ever run into issues like that in the Netherlands?
I have to say that I was quite happily shielded from serious racism. I've had very minor incidents, you know, and even just a few days ago, I took the train from Amsterdam to go to Berlin, and mm-hmm. luckily the trains are mostly empty. So, you know, we were all sitting happily there in our mostly empty carriages with our mouth masks. But I did notice that, you know, with the seven people sitting in my train car, that when the border police came, I was the only one whose passport was checked. And it didn't bother me to the point that it was an issue. Like, it's whatever, you know, so check my passport. Okay, it's done. And then I forget about it. But it's, you know, there's a part of it that kind of but then I think to myself, like, okay, so when I walked through the train car, I noticed that the rest were all a bunch of moms with kids. And when I looked in the mirror going to the toilet and I saw my beard and I saw my big black mask, and I thought to myself, I would check me as well.
Yeah, I would check you. For those exactly. that might be looking at the podcast, he looks sort of like a half Jesus character.
Half what?
Jesus. If you had to say this is what Jesus really would have looked like, that's kind exactly. of where you're at right now.
Me. It's me.
Without the glasses, though.
And I also learned that, you know, if you want to do something terrorist related, you know, look like a mom, bring some kids. That's exactly. No one's going to check you.
Yeah, if you ever look at like the 9/11 tapes when people came on, they were all wearing suits, you know. Oh. They were all, they didn't want to be conspicuous or anything.
Or speaking the Queen's English.
So I'd be curious on the transition, because you went from this hole in the wall, which mm-hmm. was, I don't know how many people we packed into that place, but you might have had 50 people in a room that should have had 20 in it exactly. at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know what I remember most is the smell. It wasn't pretty. It felt like a locker room every time you finished the session in that place. Oh, wow. and then you move towards, and I mean, for no one that's been there, it's Mezrab is on the eye. It's like you've got a theater. You've mm-hmm. really, you went from a hole in the wall to a god, like just to a proper theater.
Mm-hmm. It's an amazing location.
I mean, that's incredible. Like, how does that transition? How do you afford, like, what do you have to do to create enough income to move from this little hole into like a place where you really host set, you know, audiences?
Well, you know, I would say that the biggest transition has been that I, it went from being a one-man show, you know, just me with my parents and my brother helping out as volunteers, to being a team effort. So that's been the biggest change. So whatever it is that we're doing now, we wouldn't have been able to do it if it was just me. So for a couple of years, you know, I have partners who help out and each have their own responsibilities. We have, I don't know how many volunteers who run shifts, you know, now in Corona times, even just, you know, the person standing at the door to make sure that, you know, you've reserved your space and you don't have any conditions. It's all volunteers. It's all people helping out.
Wow.
So the biggest transition has been in creating this kind of this village that runs it. I would say that that's the biggest thing.
I'd just like to touch that. Like that sort of love and dedication only comes when you serve something greater than yourself.
Mm.
So that speaks to you, because it, you know, when times are hard and people see that others mean something to them, and the thing that means something to them is that they've selflessly given themselves to something, then you see people show up the way they have for you, which is really beautiful.
It's yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And it's been very important also for us to kind of make sure that people see that, you know, we do this because we love it. And also we get something out of it, which isn't financial gains. You know, most of us, you know, the people who even get money, I think it's around a minimum wage that we get if you calculate the hours that we put in there. Mm-hmm. But the point is that because they see that we put all that effort in, for them, it's easier to do that as well. And yesterday we had another night in the Mezrab. On Wednesday, we have these open mic nights. And a person reserved, and in the comment section, she just put, thank you for existing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had this moment where we just screenshotted that and put it in the internal WhatsApp group. And we were all like, yes, you know, another person kind of sees how important it is for us just simply to do what it is that we do, simply because we want
yeah.
this way of being together to keep on existing.
Yeah. How do you survive financially? Because, you know, you've got to, you know, if anyone sees the auditorium, it's not like it would be cheap to own and manage and run that place. So how do you like make it?
Yeah. The benefit is that the group of people that we have who work there, all of us have other projects that provide for an income.
Mm-hmm.
So, I, you know, at some point I was really surprised that one of the volunteers who, you know, twice a month comes and helps behind the bar, she's actually a professor of law in one of the Amsterdam universities. Mm-hmm. So it's like, no, people don't depend on our place. So most of the money can go towards the rent. But I personally, for instance, have my shows as a performer and as a storytelling teacher. And so do my partners. You know, there's Anastasios, who's our Greek partner, who also performs as a composer and as a theater maker and as a
really good
filmer. Yeah. And then there is, you know, my friend Carl, who's a graphic designer and he designs websites. So all of us you know, we kind of do other things that we need to do for the money. And then, you know, we come and do this for love, even though we do all the other stuff for love as well. But definitely, you know, here it's only for love. Yeah.
Wow. It's really beautiful. I mean, I knew it was, but hearing you speak it kind of amplifies it for me. It's a community of people dedicating to something greater than themselves.
Yeah.
And there's something just so beautiful in that, that every time I come near to that energy, it's just inspiring.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm never going to look at that place again the same.
I'm going to tell you how it got me into trouble.
How's that?
I wanted to buy a house. So here is me, you know, second generation migrants. Parents have been working a whole life, and they had this dream for their kids. And then there was me working my whole life. And, you know, my shows finally are running, and the income of this teaching is doing well, and I don't spend any money. And for years and years, I'm just saving. And finally, I find a place that I want to get, and we apply for a mortgage. And at the mortgage, we say, you know, that I'm an artist, and I've saved all this money. And then they look through my papers, and they see that I'm also, like, getting some money from this cafe Mesra. That's what it's called, the cafe. And they're like, yeah, but hold on, he's an artist. Why is he getting money from a cafe? And then they Google the cafe, and they see that the beers are not expensive. And they literally say, we don't take him seriously because, you know, his beers are not as expensive as they should be. So basically what the mortgage guy was saying is that he doesn't play the game of capitalism.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't trust the person who doesn't do it. And they rejected my mortgage. How weird is that?
Doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah, it's like everyone needs, again, we go back to the same thing you do for our life. You storytell. Mm-hmm. And they have a clear story that they mm-hmm. tell themselves yep. around what is and is not capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's utterly fascinating and sad.
Yeah.
But that's where we are.
That's where we are. And this is why we do what we do. You know, you guys do the show every day. It's all labors of love, just to make sure that in our own way, we show that even the things that you can't monetize are the things that are there that will make our lives more beautiful.
Yeah. And it's hard sometimes because when I'm asked, and we're asked by quite a few people that are more economically minded, they'll mm-hmm. say, hey, so what's your business strategy? And mm-hmm. and you'll kind of look at them like, do I have to make something up so that he actually takes this more seriously? Like, can we just be doing this because we love and enjoy and appreciate? And mm-hmm. it's not easy for people to grasp that.
Yeah.
Like, there has to be something that you're not telling me, because no one is that selfless.
Yeah.
No, you know, it goes back to something you said in your question from Bolalang, which was, what are the two things that make a story worth telling? The first one was?
The first one is, you know, you need to be passionate about it. It needs to mean something for you. Otherwise, you know, don't waste your breath telling
and
it.
That one point is so crucial to everything that's ever succeeded as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where this will go, you know, and who really cares if we enjoy doing it and we continue like refining our craft and learning and growing. I mean, God knows, like Bombos, he's hating this show sometimes, you know, he's just saying, Andy, what are we doing? You know? And
I don't say that.
Oh, you said on the air yesterday, I hate this program.
Or yesterday?
Two days ago. Yeah. I got it on recording. I'll play it back to you.
He's going to make like a little jingle with it.
Well, my point being is that there's something greater than the show.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beauty of trying to hold yourself to something different. Like the fact that we'll be very intimate and vulnerable while we know other people are out there. That's a dedication to something more than us.
Yeah. When I cry on the show, our ratings go up.
Wow.
That's our big
selfless prior. That's good.
Yeah, we need you to like fully like let the tears run down your face. So thank you for that, and thank you for being an inspiration in that regard.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've seen in a lot of our guests that have come on there, it's kind of interesting, the show is called The Wonderful Chaos, And one of the themes that I've seen come on, which has been really surprising for me because I didn't have an intention of seeing any pattern, but was that a lot of people have fallen into the things that actually catapulted them in their lives. So they didn't plan it. They didn't have a business strategy. It was just, it just fell on their lap and they ran with it. And it goes counter to what so many other people are telling you to do. Build your business plan, find your purpose, you know, like take your life in your own hands. And I think it's really hard for people to let go of the idea they don't have control of their own destiny.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it also, it creates this false narrative that there is a certain drive and magic and passion that you can catch in formulas.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of it will always be this, you know, sort of very formulaic work. You see it when they give, you know, in a lot of writing courses, you know, it produces formulaic writing pieces and formulaic novels. And then you remember all the writers that you admired and you see none of them took any of those writing classes or, you know, films that you saw. You know, you can always pick out those very formulaic films. And then you look at the directors that you admired and none of them, some of them didn't even go to film school. They just picked up a camera and they just went nuts with it. I have the same with the Mesrap. Sometimes we do something very successfully. And then afterwards, I can explain and go, like, oh, yeah, we did this because of this. But it's always after the fact. It's always some kind of theory you can make up. But I had no idea that that's what I was doing when we were doing it. And we just did it because it felt good. It felt natural.
Yeah. There's a term that I've brought up and I've always forgotten it, but I remember it now for the first time. The survivor fallacy. The survivor fallacy being that in World War II, the planes went out and basically all the ones that were shot up came back. And then they said they analyzed only the ones that came back and put basically supports over all those sections so that we were only analyzing the ones that made it back, which were exactly the ones we didn't need to analyze because the ones that didn't make it back were the ones that were actually hit in ways they couldn't. And I found that once, as you said, you come back and you've survived, you tell the story as if you had purpose in it where it just happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of scary though, because it's all of that bluster that feeds our desire for control, our desire for success. And then we just get stuck in this routine of chasing after the thing. And half the people that are standing in front of cars doing these Instagram photos don't own the cars they're standing in front of.
That's so true.
And yet we want to believe it's so bad that we're really ready to sell our lives for that. You know, that Ronnie said to me, Andy, I don't get it. All these people that are going to success coaches where the people that they're going to have less money than they have, except they're talking about it with more strength and confidence.
It's so true.
Put a car behind that and kind of talk about
it. Yeah, talk about it. 60 days and 60 million, you know, give us 60 days and just you'll have a 60 day window to sell the course until everyone knows you're a fraud. Or we'll create something that the Trump 2 University. If you didn't get it the first time, we've got the next Trump University for you. God, you know? There's always something outside of ourselves that we think someone else can give us that we can't give ourselves. It's one of the saddest things. And I think as a society going forward, we'll need to see that the world is already inside of us and everything is a need or a want. If we can't make peace with that inside of ourselves, we're not going to be able to do it outside of ourselves. So if anything, maybe COVID will give a big wake up call to us for that. Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah. Are there projects now you're working on that are not yet public?
Yeah. Well, it's one thing that's public in the sense that it's been posted on Facebook, but it's something we still very much have to develop and have to create, is my next show with Rafa, with whom 3 years ago we created My Father Held a Gun. And it's exciting because in this show, for the first time, we don't play ourselves. Because normally as a storyteller, or quite often as a storyteller, you're yourself on stage. And we're going to take the challenge, for me as a non-trained actor, I'm going to take the challenge of actually becoming someone else on stage. We're going to play brothers, two Kurdish brothers. So that's something exciting that we're creating this year and putting on stage. It's going to be called Sons of Abraham.
Mm.
About the biblical sons who, you know, one became the father of the Jewish tribe and one of the Arab tribe.
Wow.
So that's kind of interesting.
And the fact that they're Kurds, there's nothing good that came out of being a Kurd. So
exactly. We really wanted the people who, because, you know, also when you're an Iranian, you know, there, you look towards history and you see the moments that you suffered because of foreign forces and enemies. But then if you're honest, you also see the moments that you made other people suffer, you know, and the same goes for the Jews and the Israelis. So we thought, who can we find who, you know, pretty much always have suffered, even though actually, you know, if you look at the history, we're not going to mention it, but, you know, there's even people who suffered under the Kurds, but, you know, for the sake of simplicity, we're not going to mention that.
Who are those, by the way?
Well,
I don't know. I'm not saying they caused any trouble. I don't really know. Yeah.
Actually, I can tell you, in the you know that there was an Armenian genocide.
Yes, of course.
During Ottoman times,
yeah.
And the Armenians lived in for a large part in what today is Kurdistan, mm-hmm. And a lot of the local forces who did a lot of the killings of the Armenians were actually Kurdish.
Oh, okay.
And they did it for a few reasons. One is because, you know, they were Muslims and the Armenians were Christian. Second is that they expected that if they get rid of this of these people, that it will increase their chances of getting a home country. So this is definitely a very black page in the history of the Kurdish people.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is very interesting because Turkey, of course, denies that an Armenian genocide has happened.
Yeah.
But a lot of Kurdish communities are now apologizing.
Mm.
And this, for the Turkish government, is very problematic. It's like, why are you apologizing for this thing that never happened? It's like, well...
I once hired a doctor to work for me, and her thesis was on that genocide. So oh, wow. She would often share with me about the genocide, which is quite curious that she was working in IT industry, but that was her background.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Annette Huss, beautiful, wonderful person she was. Wow. So many things.
Doing now. We are at a loss for questions, and then we end up talking about the Armenian genocide.
Yeah, that's the idea, is that we don't really like to prepare for the show because that becomes so fabricated. And then, you know, who wants to think that we knew what we're going to talk to you about?
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Or I stall until he gets a question.
Like how I'm experiencing you so far is when you talk, there's this free flow.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own life, when I talk, sometimes I feel a block, and I'm wondering if you give a tip on how I can overcome that block. What would prevent me from speaking the fullness of the truth of what might be alive in me in that moment?
That's a very good question. I don't know if I have a very practical answer, because some of the things that I learned in my practice, I learned without learning them theoretically. So a lot of things that I learned simply by doing. And only later when I met other people, I realized that I've been building this skill set, but I don't have the tools to analyze and tell you how someone who was incredibly shy speaking in public, like if I met my 16-year-old self, I would not believe that that guy is the one who actually made a profession out of public speaking. And you'll find this actually in a lot of public speakers, that they were more shy than their... you know, they're classmates. Yeah, which is really weird because, you know, a professional athlete usually when he was a teenager was also, you know, quite athletic. But, you know, a lot of public speakers, they had to go through this very weird, awkward phase and not being able to say what it is that they want to say. So all that I can say is that if you find in some day that your words are flowing, you will find that one of the reasons why they flow is that you remember all the times that they didn't manage to flow and how frustrating life was. So it's that feeling of liberation is with what will propel you forward. And you will also slowly start to realize that actually the reason why you're not being propelled forward is because of all the inner censors. Because there isn't anyone outside of you that's second guessing what it is that you're trying to say, right? So a lot of this work is simply, you know, to kill that inner censor, to make sure that, you know, they've for many years they've held you back. They've made sure that in moments that you were, you know, almost speaking out, that, you know, they made you bite your tongue and swallow your words. and to just, you know, to grab that sensor and go like, no, I don't need you. You know what? I'm just going to make a fool out of myself and I'm going to see what that does. And then you realize that actually it felt very liberating and free.
Mm.
So I think this is kind of the process.
It almost feels that when it happens in me that I'm in my way. Mm-hmm. So then I might do something like this. Or I might start singing or gibberish.
Uh-huh.
To the point that I'm not making any sense anymore, but I just feel sorry for the people in front of me.
I think that's perfect. I think that's a great mechanism to just get rid of that sensor. Because, yeah, you know, once you've made a sound like a horse, you know, no one cares what comes out anymore.
You're free. I think what you said is like genius, because I can't see, you know, anyone that hires me. I always say, you don't hire me because I'll make your company successful. You hire me because I've made so many mistakes. I know it doesn't work. So in some ways, like, it's the freedom to know that it's okay to fuck up and mm-hmm. allow, you know, and one of the things I'll do in the training, and it's one of the paramount things to someone being successful in their life, and this I really do feel what I'm going to say right now, yeah, is that they learn how to interact in a way which opens up a dialogue. And the only way I know how to open up a dialogue is really to do practical thing, which is start your sentence with what, why, or how.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start it with how and then you don't know what you're going to say after it, it's even better. If you think before you say how, mm-hmm. then you've already precluded whatever the channeling of your inner being can actually manifest. You don't know what you're going to say. But like half the times when I'll ask,
how do you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, great question, you know?
Yeah.
And I could answer that question. It'd take me ages. So how has it been for you to be on the show? Or when is it most difficult for you to do the storytelling nights? Or how would it be if you were in front of a group and you were naked? You know, I mean, I don't know.
This is a historic moment. From this point on, any guest, I'm just going to be, how?
Yeah, I would hope you do that. And then just like, even if you do, and the beauty is if you pause for 3 seconds, it makes it even more powerful what you're going to say after it, because it's almost like, wow, whatever he's going to say, he's given a lot of thought to it. So it's going to be really more. So I do believe that there is a channeling that we don't allow, because we're fearful that whatever comes out might be stupid. Where, let's just say, if it were stupid and then you could acknowledge that it was stupid, it's even more powerful. Like, there's no losing.
What?
There's no losing.
Yeah. Listen, I was taking an improv class many years ago with this beautiful improviser, and he had a student who kept asking him, why is this exercise interesting? Why is it beneficial? Why is it good? And he got so frustrated that at some point he exploded. He said, this exercise is good for 6 reasons. And then he started naming the reasons. And afterwards I asked him, like, wow, it really had 6 reasons? And he said, no, I was just pissed off. So I named a random number. And then I thought to myself, now I have to justify it. Now I have to come up with 6 reasons why it's important what we're doing. So it might have been 2, it might have been 10.
I did the same thing, but I normally do 3 to 5, because if I were to do 6, I'd be afraid I couldn't get that far. So that person is far more evolved than I've become. And I'll only do 3 or 5. There's 3 reasons. Ronnie, last night, it was really funny. We're in bed. This is actually a true story.
Go on.
We're in bed. Ronnie says to me, Andy, I have to give a course. And I don't exactly know how to do it. So this is what I said to her. I said, babe, it's 5 sections. You make it in 5 sections, because then you give people a sense of control. You give them a sense that they know the journey they're going to. And then I said, and you break each one of those sections into 3 parts. And each part is the didactic section, where you say, this is what we're going to learn and how we're going to learn it. Then you split them into groups where they have some time of time to integrate or to speak. And then the 3rd one is integration. And then I realized, oh shit, there's really a 4th one. Then the 4th one is a question answer, but we'll tack that on. But I mean, I said it and I heard myself speak through these phases, not knowing that I had this as some latent understanding in my head. And I'm like, damn, I could make a course like this really quickly.
Did you record this?
No.
Okay, we have it here now.
But I mean, that was it. I was like, babe, that's your course. And I asked her today if it was of any value to her, and she said no. So
okay,
it was at least my effort.
That was the bedtime story.
So what are your 3 takeaways for your time with Sahan today, Bambos?
Oh, as you were speaking about your father, I realized I had a lot of humorous moments with my father, even though he was like we're in the car. I think I'm 6 years old and we're driving and he's speeding. He's like a Cypriot speeding in England, doesn't take the law for regard, and the cops stop us. He turns around, he slaps me in the face. I start crying and the police officer says, well, you were speeding. He said, my son is sick, I'm taking to hospital.
Wow.
That's the kind of guy he was.
Just to let you know, we've been on 83 shows, and this is the first time, son, that Bambos has told a story about his father.
Wow. Amazing.
And I actually thought it was going to be a nice story because you've never said anything nice about your father. So I thought – and he's in the situation not unlike you where he comes to the show and he'd like to be open and free, but he's not in a society that celebrates that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I talked to my brother on the weekend, and when I cried because he told me that when he came on the show, because I also had him on the show as well, how much I shared my gratitude to him for, as I shared the history of my own family, because my dad was very abusive. I acknowledged that in outing me, I outed the rest of the family, and that wasn't necessarily easy or comfortable, and they didn't say a word of it to me. They didn't give me a hard time. They didn't blame me. And even talking about now, I think I could cry, is that there's a level of love there that, that I just, I can't, I, I've never not appreciated. Mm. And when I see Bambos in a situation where, you know, he doesn't want to hurt people in his life and you not wanting to hurt your dad, and yet all saying there's a truth in me that if I don't live that and express it, I'm also not living my full potential. Mm-hmm. There's a beauty in that that I just find really admirable in both of you for going there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our hour. Thank you for being here with us. Yeah. I don't know what you expected, but this is a wonderful chaos.
It certainly is. Yeah.
Thank you. And we'll see you at Mezrab. Yeah. For those who don't know, they can go to the I. Is there anything you'd like for people to know that might be watching?
Well, normally I would just tell them come. And now with Corona, it's wise to reserve. So just go to the website, mezrab.nl.
And so there's social distancing within the.
Exactly. So we can only allow a limited amount of people in. And this is why people now have to reserve.
And it's a great venue.
Incredible venue.
I've been there where we actually have music bands like of high caliber and the love stories, the love dating stories. Mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah, and it's in a beautiful location. You're on the water, on the eye. I mean, you know, it's magical.
Rustic.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was fun. Mm. Your dad slapped you, and then he got you out of a ticket. Did he get a ticket, or did the cop let you go?
Me go? I was six.
Did the cop let you go?
Yeah.
Jesus. You know, to think to yourself, I've been on 82 shows. That's the nicest thing you could say about your dad. Like, that's your best memory of you and your dad.
Oh, it was the funniest memory.
Oh, the funniest. I'm sure you being smacked. God. Yeah, people don't realize how rough a childhood you had. You know, you really had it rough, right? Yeah. So as you struggle through it, you know, part of our journey on this show is kind of you being able to kind of relive that in another framing, you know?
More humorous.
Yeah. All right. Or feeling in the deep pain that's also there, you know? Thank you for joining us on
A Wonderful
Chaos.
It's a wonderful chaos. We like it down.